Welcome to episode 3 of the Discovery Files. Today we're going to interview Steve Radford. Anyways, I figure I'll just turn it over to you to kind of describe what your experience was and what you remember leading up to that and what was happening during that time and all the other chaos of managing an actual gigantic drill program as well as Invincible.
Yeah, look, thanks. Thanks, Scott. Yeah, so my role was the Geological Services Supervisor. So that was looking after, you know, the field crew on the rigs and in the core yard, as well as the, you know, earthworks contractors, the drilling contractors, and pretty much everything that we needed to do to get the programs completed. And, yeah, look, I think, you know, going back to Invincible, maybe even before Invincible started, some context. Obviously, brownfields drilling around St. Ives mining camp. And I think one of the things that maybe sets the scene a little bit is, like most gold mines in the goldfields, St. Ives sort of was running on a, you know, a 2 to 4 year mine life, and had sort of been running on that for, you know, maybe 10 years beforehand. And basically that there was always this objective that, you know, every few years you've basically got to find, you know, maybe 1 million ounces to keep the show on the road. And, you know, so there was this history of finding those sometimes extensional, sometimes new ore bodies, you know, Athena, Hamlet, Neptune, a few others. And so there was this history of being able to find something and drill it out. And I think what the, you know, one of the challenges with Invincible was the drill out was on the lake, the Salt Lake, and quite a way out on the Salt Lake as well. So we were, you know, we were pretty fortunate that we had a drill contractor, Ausdrill, able to, you know, had these lake-based rigs, these massive drill rigs with these, you know, meter and a half wide tracks that had really low pressure that could actually drive out onto the lake. And yeah, I can't understate how much of a mess it is to drill on the lake and those early air core days, you know, driving out on these rigs. Or, you know, we had some Haglunds, some tracked vehicles made for the snow and the mud that we used to get out there. And basically you'd have a mud bath on the air core rig. You know, frequently, yeah, we had issues with the, you know, the salt and the water would eat the bag numbers off. So you sort of had to be pretty quick with your sampling. Sometimes we had to rebag into clean bags to sort of keep preserve the sample integrity. But yeah, so that's a little bit of the same. And yeah, when we went out and hit that Invincible, we sort of started dedicating quite a bit of resources to it. And one thing about goldfields is they were always keen to put money into the ground. So drilling, you know, going out and following up some air core hits with, you know, a diamond program, it was always no questions asked. But I think, you know, if you needed money for anything else, like people or maybe a new core soil, that was always a challenge. I'd always push back on that.
Yeah. I think I remember you struggling to try and procure like things like quads and 6x6s that could handle salt lakes and things like that as well, right? So even just getting the necessary equipment to get your people there was a big deal, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like just to free up the I guess the way it was working was you had to be there in the morning when the drillers went out, and it might be a 45-minute drive across the lake in a tractor machine. And so getting to a quad or a six-wheeler of our own just made that a little bit easier. You know, geologists didn't have to be out there like at the crack, you know, crack of dawn or the start of every shift. You know, they had a bit more flexibility to come and go as required. But even they weren't a 100% solution because they got bogged, you know, sometimes, and they broke down and the salt damage, you know, as with all these things. So there was a bit of adversity, and I think once had sort of made the discovery, you know, we then worked on building that, you know, the giant causeway out to the project, which in itself was quite a big undertaking. So I think it's really great to, I guess, the story of the logistics and the drilling and the earthworks that maybe doesn't get told in these stories of discovery is that everyone, you know, we still had other drill programs going on. So we were still doing project generation, I think we might have been drilling Neptune at the time as well. And then here we are, we've got this other program now happening at Invincible. And it was, here's more rigs, but not necessarily, more people, more vehicles, more resources. And so, yeah, like it's a lot of pressure for the team.
Yeah, no, I imagine, because I know, I think when I first started, you were like senior fieldy, and then you became the head of like field service, or was it field services? Is that what it was called?
Geological services.
Geological services. And so I guess, how did your people deal with this during this time? Because I mean, like, that's kind of a lot of misery, right? Like, it was, I think it was during the middle of summer when they found this. And so it was probably like 50 degrees on the Salt Lake or something like that, right? Did like, was it challenging, like managing people? Were they like trying to keep people motivated? And what was that whole side of things like?
Yeah, look, I think it's, I think one of the things that was most interesting for me, and like still to this day, the group of people that we had in that core farm, was the probably the best team that I've ever worked with. And, I think a lot about why that was. And I think it was a combination of, all of a sudden we had this, this adversity, this situation that everyone's just piled in, like core, it's pouring into the core yard. There's a lot of earthworks rigs, we need some supervision out on the guys building the causeways, so that the work level went up. And I think the team, when I look back, there was a lot of questions on the team about, is this team capable? And then it turns out very capable. And it's, I don't want to say that there's, any ageism in mining. But it's not infrequent, I think, to have exploration teams and certainly field teams that are quite young, in their 20s, 30s. And the average age of the team, I think, it was 51 at this time.
And that's a lot of that, those years were spent at St. Ives too, right? So it was people that really knew the site well as well, right?
There was a lot of people that knew the site really well. It's a new people. But I think that was kind of the thing at St. Ives. You had a lot of people that had been there for a long time, and I think that was pretty helpful. So like, even the drill crews, like the supervisors, had been out there for their whole careers. So
Yeah.
they were, gave them that technical know-how, I guess, for drilling on the lake through the unconsolidated service at the top. Yeah, it was fantastic.
It's kind of interesting, now I'm in my 40s and I know even doing like I just rebuilt a retaining wall around some thing in the front yard the other day. I don't find it nearly as easy as I did 10 years ago. And so I was just thinking about, I had a fairly hard time trying to move samples around and do chipping and all that stuff when I was out on the Salt Lake, and I was probably, I guess, in my late 20s, early 30s, something like that. I was just thinking about like that would be such a physically demanding job in your 50s, right? So that's pretty impressive how much effort those guys put in. But yeah, I just like tell me about your team. What was the team like?
Yeah, look, it was what was I say? It was a bit of a diverse team. So we had a few women in the core yard. We had some really good guys. Alex, I think, was 68 and still working. And he'd been out there, since WMC days. And he was a great, and I don't think I've ever worked with anyone who's worked as hard as what he did. So that was, he really, I think, set the tone for the workforce. And yeah, we had guys, Paps was leading the core yard. Great guy again, heaps of experience, lots of stories to tell. Kay, probably too
Yeah.
many, to be honest, that I could remember. But I think, and I think, I reflect on it as well, because I was in my 20s at that time. And I certainly didn't appreciate then what it was like doing the activity at, in your 40s and 50s. And
Yeah,
so I think
yeah.
the lesson I've learned is, don't, you can't expect, 20-year-old performance from someone who's 50. But what, but what you can, ex well, I think what I learned is these people rocked up every day, and we had some younger people come in, contractors, and they'd be blowing shifts. They'd be getting drunk at the pub. They'd
Yep.
come in hangover, And it's like, great, when you're working and you're fit, you're super productive, but 30% of the time you're not.
And it's kind of been the story of almost all the exploration projects where you're constantly churning through younger people who it might be their first job, or they might just be doing a job temporarily until a better job comes along. And so it's hard to emphasize just how difficult that turnover is for everybody involved, because when they dump a shift, you show up and all of a sudden you have to do twice as much work, right? So it's not like you can be like, oh, hey, we're not going to sample over here today. And I was just thinking about how key it is to reduce turnover and how little we focus on it as an industry, right? Where it's very, very few people make intentional decisions to try and keep people on. Like, you were saying this guy on from the WMC days, right? Like that's kind of wild to think about. He's seen the changing of the guard and all these things. And how many things has he learned over the years that make the day-to-day job go better that nobody even appreciates, right?
Yeah, and that's right. And so that's, I think that's what you get with that sort of experience is people know what needs to be done and they know what's coming up. So, you'd find, he'd be preparing for next week's jobs on Wednesday the week before. He's like, yeah, I know that's coming up. So, I'm getting ready because I'm tagging Cortre. So I'm actually pre-tagging because I'm gonna, I'm gonna go and stick that eyes on next week. So he'd be doing this prep work days ahead to make his job easier. In the future. So that's a great lesson for anyone, I think, to take away is don't just think about what you're doing for today, but look for tomorrow, and next week as well.
Yeah. It must have been, I don't know what the right word is, intimidating maybe is not quite it. It must have been a bit of a burden coming in your 20s, and you were very motivated and very good, and so it's probably easier. But then jumping into managing this team that, like, with the average experience being twice your age, it must have been kind of wild.
Yeah, look, I think when you're young, you just embrace things and you take them on. But I think one thing that I've always been fortunate enough to have been around people older than me who are prepared to teach you the things that they know, and I've learned long ago to accept that people that have been around and even new people now will know how to do things better than what I do. So as long as you're prepared to listen to someone and go, oh, okay, that's way better than what I was thinking. Let's do it that way. As long as you've got that open mindset, yeah, I think it's really good for you and it's good for the team and good for the people you work with.
Yeah.
Do you think that mindset that you had, do you think that's something that's come with age, or is that something you had at the start?
I think I've always had that. And I think, I grew up on a farm down south. And when you're growing up on a farm, you're constantly being told by other people the right way to do things because you're always messing up, right? So I'm always doing things wrong. And so from a very young age, I just used to the fact that the people I'm around probably know how to do this job better than I do. And so you've just gotta sort of run with that. And I still have that now. So.
It's an interesting point you make, because I think a lot of what you do, I mean, this would be a good perspective to get from you. A lot of what you do, I think, in exploration and mining is so different from, I guess, the day-to-day stuff that you do, that I think you probably need to have that the mindset that you're like the growth mindset that you're talking about, right? That like you have to accept that other people might know more than you do. And it's funny because like I think even from a technical point of view, I think, like often you come out of university knowing all these things, and I think you probably use like maybe 2% of what you learn in university on your first day-to-day job, because like a lot of stuff is really alien. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of people, because they fall in that hole, because they go, well, I should know all of these. Now people are expecting me to know this rather than I actually asking for help.
Yeah, well, I think if you don't know, you just have to wing it. But similarly, right? So I think there's at some point in my career there's maybe been a turning point. So now I'm perhaps the older statesman who's been around for 20 years, and I guess a lot of that field-based knowledge and experience. But now there's a new generation coming in, and they're really embracing like new technological solutions. And so suddenly now I'm, you know, I've got to, you know, I'm looking at these people going, wow, this is, you know, I wish we had this 20 years ago. Like, these tools are fantastic. So, you know, I think that as long as your mindset is someone has got something to teach me, that'll really set you up for your life. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, that's a good perspective.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting. You guys, I remember when you were doing MagSus, there wasn't like software where you could, you know, easily digitize all of the data, right? And so I remember like it was the first time I'd seen anybody, you know, start dictating into I think it was an iPhone, and, you know, like they're doing depths and MagSus readings and they're dictating it. And then they would listen back to that and type it in. And I was like, I'd never thought to do that before. And it was like, there's a lot of little things that were just like workarounds to overcome the problems, right? And it was just this group of young people, and I guess not as young people too, that were just constantly figuring out ways around the hurdles, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was because there were so many samples coming in and so much drilling happening, like you really had to find the fastest and most efficient way to do things. And, you know, I think at a later date, you know, we got the next model up, you know, MagSus meters and, you know, Logchief, and we were able to get some of that digital entry, which saved some time. But certainly, yeah, before that, you know, we were trying all sorts of different things. And, you know, when the bags are wet, yeah, that was just, yeah, someone came up with this idea, like just put your phone in your pocket and take the readings and record it and, you know, sit back in the office later and put them in. It's like, wow, what a great idea, because you can get a lot of readings really quick. And I think that's like again, this is where the context sits in, is, you know, we were sort of pumping out 300,000-400,000 meters of drilling a year across exploration and, you know, some underground production drilling. So, you know, in any given month there might be 40,000+ samples going to the lab. So if you got caught up or you fell behind, things got really challenging really, really quickly. So you just had to find a way to make that work.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel overwhelmed, Steve, in that job?
I think I didn't necessarily feel overwhelmed, but I was certainly surrounded by people who were overwhelmed.
Yeah.
A lot.
that was me for sure.
and so I guess an example is, so, you know, for people that maybe haven't been to St. Ives, the courtyard at St. Ives is massive. So I think we had racks for about 28,000 meters of core. So at any one time, you know, we could sort of have that sort of 28,000 meters of core up on the racks. And, you know, when you're sort of drilling 1,000 meters a day coming in, one stage there, I think we started falling behind and the racks were full. And so there's a lot of pressure on to, well, take core down and then put new core up, and then we'll have to put the other core back up. So you really, you know, really got to sort of hold firm a little bit and say, no, like, maybe just come and process this core that's here, because every time we double handle, like, we just don't have the resources to be moving thousands of core trays a day and stockpiling. But yeah, we did get at one stage, I think we did have something like 20,000 meters sitting in the yard that couldn't go on the racks, you know, while we were processing core. And there was a lot of people getting pretty nervous at that point, because that's a lot of core.
Yeah. I remember being so, I don't even know what the right word is, awestruck when I first got a tour of the core farm, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, this can fit however many thousands of meters on the racks. And then, oh yeah, there's, you know, 12 million meters of core at the different core farms around. And so, you know, we can get it to you here in a couple of days if you need it. And it was like 12 million meters of core. And it's just the scale of that operation and what your team is having to do to keep up with the rigs and keep up with the geos. And, you know, cause that's all the stuff that happens behind the scenes, right? Where, like, I've worked for little companies that gave me so much more respect for what you and the team did there, because we had to do it all ourselves as geologists, and we didn't have a good system worked out. So we weren't very good at it. And it was so slow and painful, and being able to just show up and have all of the core on the rack and ready to go, and it's like, you know, here's a message when it's ready. And it's like, that was amazing stuff.
Yeah, and I think I'm not sure if we had it before you left Scott, but you know, we built a few tools, I guess, over the journey when I was there as well. So we had the big manual boards in the courtyard, with 70 or 80 holes written on it. We digitized that. We had it sort of plugged into the database as well, similar to, like Paul had one for the geos tracking the logging, and we sort of started we built the same system for the courtyard, so anyone could see, when the core was up, when it had been meter marked. So the geo office was maybe what, 15 km away, 15-minute drive maybe. So, you could be sitting in your office and go, oh yeah, my core's up and it's marked. Sweet. I'll come down now and do some logging, or maybe I'll stop in tomorrow morning before coming into the office and get that core out.
Yeah. And it was kind of an interesting, I don't know, I was just thinking about the challenges where, like our team, I think it was like 14 people and we might've gotten to 15 right before the layoffs. And then there was, I think, six more and I forgot the word for it. Like it was like the next department. And then I think six more and the other one after that. And so you had to deal with like 30 geologists, right? And so like, and I know like, with geologists, they always say, like 30 geologists is 45 opinions, right? So, but that must have been challenging to keep everybody relatively happy while just churning through core, right? And NRC and Air Corps and everything else too, right?
Yeah, and I think that's, whilst Invincible was happening, we still had multiple air rigs going, we had RC rigs going, like the rest of the site didn't stop while that was happening. I think we sort of probably had 10, 12 rigs turning on the surface at any one time. And so yeah, so once resources started coming onto Invincible, that's where you had that pressure from the other geologists going, hey, what's happening to my samples or my core? And there was certainly, some of the things like the air core samples might sit out there for a few weeks, and there was definitely some in-team tension about getting their samples to the lab.
I remember showing up like when I went out to log air core and at the beginning, and I had no idea what I was doing. And I remember showing up one day and the wind had shifted overnight and all of my samples had sailed away. And I was like, what is this? Where'd the samples go? And it was like, they're like a kilometer away. So like, how did you guys deal with stuff like that? 'Cause that was maybe not a regular occurrence, but it happened often enough, right?
So I think this is for me, like maybe signaled as well the way that Goldfields looked at things. And I think Julian, the manager, was a big believer in sort of looking at the bigger picture. And so he looked and said, well, if we hired another geo and another fieldie and we sat on the rig all day every day, there's a cost to that. And the flip side is that occasionally, maybe your samples blow away, or we can't work out what's going on with that hole and we have to redrill that hole. But the cost to redrill a hole might be, for an air core short oil, air core hole might be $1,500. But you might spend $20,000 having crew out there. So it's like, okay, as long as we don't have to redrill more than 10 holes a month, we're probably on top. So I think that, there was really this attitude of how do we get as much money into the ground as possible? And maybe, and like that's certainly not a junior mentality. You would, junior mentality is have someone on the rig all the time, make sure every sample's correct. But I think Goldfields just took a step back and went, well, actually, if something does mess up, maybe that's okay, because we're saving the resources of having people and vehicles and equipment there all the time.
It's an interesting point, right? Because we often focus on perfection and sampling and perfection and every aspect of it. But that is actually one of those areas that you can get away with it. It's not like Aisha was talking about if you're trying to drill in the Yukon, right? And it's, you can't go back until like next year. That's a totally different story. But when it's literally like, okay, take the air core rig and reroute it over here, drill a couple holes, come back. It's a very different, and as long as you appreciate those costs, perfection isn't necessary, right? So that's a good point.
Yeah, I think so. I think for things like that. But I think that as well is having really good like quality checks so that you pick those things up, while the rig's in the area, or you know, before you start sending things to the lab that maybe, you know, haven't been sampled properly. And I think we did that really well at Goldfields. Is sample quality control was pretty spot on.
Yeah. I really felt that was one of the best sites I've seen for QAQC. And you know, a lot of sites just focus on measuring quality instead of actually assuring quality, right? And so it's really important to make those changes and to say, okay, you know, like we need to go back to, are we sampling correctly? And even things like that, like training, you said 12 fieldies. Well, it wasn't just fieldies, right? It was Core Shed and it was everybody else. But training all these people to do consistent work, is that must have taken up a lot of your time.
This is where kudos to the team, right? And that when new people came in, we had like these great people to be able to mentor them and sort of show them with their experience, hey, this is how we make things happen. We were really good at changing a process. So, you know, at other places they had this, you know, 10 pages long process, and then when you get to the job, it's, oh, here's all the real shortcuts. And I think at Goldfields, we just said, well, let's get rid of the 15 pages. Now it's 2 pages, and that's the process, because the way you're doing it is how we've done it for 10 years, and that's delivering the results. Why say we're doing something we're not? And I think that sort of mentality, you know, really helped streamline that process, streamline the training, because, hey, this is what we're telling you we're doing is what we're actually doing. And, you know, there are no shortcuts, because the shortcuts have become the process.
Yeah. It takes a lot of discipline to do that, right? It's much easier to write up a perfect document that covers every little step and then have everybody not use it because it misses key things and it's difficult to update and it's a process. I was really impressed when I started there. You know, I like left Alaska and I came to you know, Western Australia, and that itself was quite a shock. But then how fast I got up and running in terms of having a computer, having all the IT access and all that stuff, and hitting the ground. I think it was like in the first week I was already like logging aircore or something like that. It was a really short time. And it was a lot of those things were like those documents, you know, like the control documents, and then assigning people to kind of mentor you through this aspect or that aspect. You know, it's like, go talk to this person, they're going to help you with this. And I was just really impressed with how easy it was to start there for being so completely different geologically than anything I'd ever experienced.
Yeah. And look, I don't know if that's the WMC influence coming through, but they were really big on making sure that everyone just had maximal training. And just anything that you wanted to do to grow yourself, it's like, just, they were so supportive. Just go and do it. Is that going to make you a better employee? Go and do it. And, you know, I remember, I think there was a meeting and someone said, oh, we're doing all this training, what if people leave? And it was like, great. Then we're sending super talented people out into the workforce and they're going to say how good we are. And, you know, to this day, I've never heard anyone say a bad thing about, you know, St. Ives and Goldfields, about how they grow and develop their people. And ultimately some of those people end up coming back because they're like, wow, this was such a great place.
Yeah. What do you think is one of the hidden daily things that you had to deal with that was absolutely critical that the average geologist, you know, because most of the listeners on our show are probably going to be geologists, but like, yeah. So what would you say is something that they should know that they don't even have a clue is going on behind the scenes to make their life actually possible?
probably just working overtime to make sure that everything happens. But I think there's a layer of relationship building that perhaps they don't see. So where you're engaging with your earthworks team and you're going out and you're getting a really good feel for what's happening on the ground. And then I guess those relationships are also across site. So, you know, we had a drill request process, and a lot of the steps on that process are all sort of happening away from the geologist. So they're doing the technical part, and then it's, you know, well, you know, you're liaising with, you know, the enviro team, the, you know, the technical team, the mechanical services, the electricians, you know, if you're going under or near power lines. So there's like a whole world of things that's happening in the background, you know, site inspections, and maybe juniors, geologists are doing all of those things. But I think at St. Ives, it was, you know, the geos were really, you know, insulated, perhaps doing a lot of the technical work, and all of that other stuff just sort of was just happening, you know, in the background. And, you know, I think there was, you know, one day you know, was given a pile. I think it was like 13 drill requests for 13 drill programs. And, you know, it's like, that's a lot of work you got to go out, do, you know, you're doing, you know, recon, you're engaging with these people, and you're taking the earthworks contractors out there, showing them where they can go, pegging sites with the surveyors. So there's this whole, I guess, logistical machine that just happens in the background. And at Goldfields, it was happening pretty smoothly. So we had some really good people in all those jobs. And yeah, understanding what was the priority is, you know, critical.
Hey, Steve, so the question I have here is, it sounds like you've been on both sides of the fence, right? Like you've worked in a setup like St. Ives where, let me try to describe it, right? You know, where the operational team is kind of separated from the technical team, right? Like they each have kind of their job roles. Whereas in smaller companies, those roles often overlap, but on both sides, yeah, like the geologist sometimes has to do the fieldy work and the fieldy sometimes has to do the geology work. Do you get a sense, I mean, like, I'm curious to know your opinion on whether you think, you know, like that segregation is good, or would you prefer like smaller teams where there's more cross-pollination between the two? Do you have an opinion on like, what do you think has worked better for you in the past or not?
I think my opinion is that your technical people deliver the most value when they're doing technical work, and it's an ongoing discussion, right? Because if you're at a junior and you've got one or two geos and one or two fieldies, and maybe they're contract fieldies for a drill program, you know, your geos have to do that work. But I think if you think about how, I guess, things operate now, particularly in Australia, you know, I can't talk about other jurisdictions, but there's so much work that has to be done to get on the ground, that if you can have someone do that and have your geologist really focusing and working on the geology, I think your chances of success will go up. You know, I think that's been my experience.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too.
Yeah, it's a good point because I often think, having been in this situation, I sometimes think, you got to let bakers bake bread, right? Like, let people do things that they're good at and allow people to kind of do the things that they're good at. But you can understand why that overlap happens. I think to your point, I think it's important for geologists and fieldies to understand what each other do. So having a little bit of apprenticeship into what they're doing, what the challenges each faces, I think is good. So you don't get the ridiculous requests like here's 20 drill holes you gotta set up today or whatever it is. But I think in general sense, I think it's an interesting viewpoint that. I think things run smoother on your side if you do somewhat segregate the jobs a little bit.
Yeah, but to your point, it is, it's really important that both sides understand what the other side's doing. And there's some of the best geos that I've worked with have been fieldies, and either intentionally or they started as fielding became geos. Certainly in the older days, we would. There were geos who had to be fieldies because there was no geo work. And I think that really just sort of sets those people up for success later because they know what they're asking people to do. So when a ridiculous request comes in, it's like they know it's a ridiculous request. And they're like, look, just give it your best shot and we'll see what happens. Whereas, perhaps some people that have come out and don't have that experience, they have no idea. Like they may not know what this work that goes in behind the scenes. And
sorry.
They may not have time for that either. And I think I see that a lot in companies where, as a geologist, they're still being expected to do the geological work. And meanwhile, they're also having to do the admin and they're recruiting or, mm-hmm. Engaging with these companies to do earthworks or people or logistics. And like, that's a big part of their day. And suddenly their job that they love has become, for them, an administrative role, but actually it's like, no, that's actually like some project management skills in there that it's great for you to have, but that takes away from your ability, I think, to sort of sit there, process and look at the data.
Mm-hmm. It's a really good point. I had early in my career, I started at a small company, and there was enough people I worked with that had, you know, worked through the, I think it kind of stopped in the late 90s. And they were describing that when they started as a geologist, they did geology, pretty much straight geology. And they had a draftsman in the office that actually did the drafting work. They had a secretary that did, you know, filing and phone calls and arranging things. And there was all these different departments. And then they said they slowly watched in the late 90s, kind of, you know, gold was going down. They kind of got rid of these different departments, and the geologists were still there. So then they just put those responsibilities on the geologists, and then they started doing less and less and less geology, and also becoming more disheartened about it, right? Because they signed up to do exploration, right? They signed up to go hike around in the field and, you know, map or whatever their specialty was. And I kind of think about that sometimes. We have all these things that relate to our declining discovery rates. How much of it is that geologists don't do geology anymore?
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point. And, you know, going back to, I think gold, the attitude at Goldfields was as much time and effort was going into the ground and the geology as possible. And, you know, I think I remember at one time, you know, myself and a geo got sort of pulled into the office, and the geo had done a purchase order. And we both got pulled in. So why is this geologist doing purchase orders? And it was like, and for me, that was leadership walking the talk and saying, hey, I've noticed this. I don't want it. You're paid to be a geologist. I'm paid to look after geological services. Great. Maybe they were helping me out, or it was something specific they wanted for a project. And so they were doing it. But actually, taking the 5 or 10 minutes to do that, that's not your job. You know, and so I think, you know, that was really consistent with the way that they ran. And for me, it was perhaps a discipline that a lot of companies miss. And, you know, I've worked at companies since and before. And, you know, one of the gripes, I guess, that you hear it on, you know, doing engagement surveys, you know, 60% of my time is admin. And so if you have a team of 10 geos and 60% of the time is admin, you actually have a team of 4 geos. And you're wondering why you can't get work done, or your geology is not as good. It's like, well, maybe we need to look at that.
And it's a good point too, right? Because I was just thinking about, you could have had the same exact conversation, and if the person saying, why is this person doing POs, didn't have respect for the role that you're doing, that could come off as very condescending, right? But if you know them and you respect them and vice versa, you know that it's not a conversation there's no condescension there. It's like, we need to free up these people to do their job, just like you need to be freed up to do your job. And I think that's an important step, is the trust of, you know, like the whole way up and down the chain, right? From the brand new fieldy out, you know, sitting on an air core rig, or maybe showing up to an air core rig, all the way up through the exploration manager or you know, the VPX or whatever. So that way, when you have a conversation like that, you know it's coming from a position of respect and not one of disrespect, right? Because otherwise, it could lead to a very different outcome, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, there's the objectives and what everyone needs to do is really well defined. And so when you have those conversations, like, look, this is not a personal thing. It's not an attack, or not, you know, demeaning or saying you're not doing your job in any way. It's just, I've noticed this. This is what we're trying to do. You know, we've got to find these ounces. We've got to do these drill outs. You know, they're doing their job, and hey, they're just going to pass things to you. And maybe you're busy, and you know, you need to prioritize things. But if that starts becoming a problem, we can deal with that when it is.
What was one of your favorite parts about working at St. Ives? I'm just kind of curious. Like, what when you think back on it, what is a good moment for you?
Yeah, look, there was quite a few. Like one of the, I guess one of the good parts for me personally was I'd spent a lot of time working FIFO, probably 10, 15 years before St. Ives, and then coming to a residential role, you know, home to see the family every night. Like that was just personally, that was probably one of my favorite things. But from a side, just the people, like just a really great group of people. It's hard to sort of describe it. like it was a very diverse group of people, but maybe because it's residential, you know, it's like a tighter knit and you can engage outside of work. You know, there's always things happening. So yeah, that's, you know, that team coming together, I think was really good, really fun.
Yeah, I agree. I think that was just, it made it work, right? Like I think about how much tension there was during like that Invincible discovery, but anytime you're turning that many rigs, right? Like you're going to have some tension. But because I think everybody got along well, I still remember that, what was the Geos versus the rest of the world footy match, right? And it was like, I think it was like the year before I got there, like one of the senior Geos had like 4 broken ribs from it. But it was like, it was so many things like that, right? Like, you know, what was it on Fridays? They had the morning tea where it was like everybody took half an hour to go and, you know, you'd bring food from wherever you were from. And the only thing you could ask was, is it sweet or is it savory?
Yeah.
So for me, I'd never had anything from anywhere else. I grew up in a small town in California, right? And I loved that. That was amazing to just have those conversations for a half an hour. And then, I don't know, like all those little, I don't know if they're, I wouldn't say unintentional team building acts, but certainly not, you know, because it's very easy to create these almost like that same thing, that condescending team building, right? Where it's like, oh, we're going to go and do this and build teamwork. And that very rarely builds teamwork, right? It's those things where people actually want to spend time with each other and chat and smash each other playing AFL.
Yeah, definitely a lot of organic events like that. Like lots of people outside of work, you know, they're playing sport together. You know, I think Mary Jane was did swimming lessons at the, you know, at the pool where my kids are doing swimming lessons. So, you know, like really that sense of, hey, like, yeah, we don't actually need team building where the team's just doing that organically. I think it's really good. And I think the other thing is as well, and this is perhaps one of the lessons for I think teams is you sort of had these people like Malcolm and Julian that really set the tone of what was expected. And then really just supported the team in going to do that. So I had, you know, there was very little interference in my day-to-day job. It was like, hey, you know what you're supposed to do. Every conversation we have, we know what we're supposed to be doing and it's happening. So I think that's, you know, that needs a lot to that team, even though there's often friction within the team. As long as everyone knows we're working towards this goal and it's consistent and we're supported, that's just the team getting on with it.
And it's interesting you guys like talk about, like, you know, what you guys are talking about, I think is kind of culture, right? Like how you build the culture in the team. And what I find really interesting is like, you know, the last thing management should sometimes do is be involved in building the culture, you know, because I think they're just not the people that are going to actually inspire, you know, like you need kind of like your colleagues or your peers to kind of do that culture building more rather than management coming in saying, hey, you know, like, Friday 9 to 10 is our culture building hour or team building hour. Like, yeah, like I don't think it ever works that way, right?
Yeah.
I think it's worked much better when they kind of get out of the way and the peers kind of keep you honest and say, and like, you know, like the behaviors that you're talking about, management picking up, you know, like I would expect that your peers probably picked up on more of those behaviors where they would go, hey, hang on a second, Steve, you know, that's not what we should be doing. And that's what we should be doing. That's our job. We should step in here, things like that.
Yeah, well, it becomes self-reinforcing, I think, with the team. You know, it's the classic management. You know, they might model the behaviors, but yeah, you don't have to be having those implicit conversations all the time. It's like, oh man, we understand.
Yeah, that's how I am.
The team understands.
And I think that's actually a good maybe piece of advice for a lot of managers out there. I think it's more important to model what you want people to do than to tell them, right? Because you knew where you stood with Julian and you knew where the program stood with Julian and Malcolm as well. And I never felt that there was that condescending, you know, like manufactured, you know, thing. It was always very much, he modeled what he expected and didn't have to say it. We actually interviewed him a few days ago and we were talking about just the difficulties of people management sometimes is a gigantic challenge, right? And it's I think there's more art than science there, right? And if you say one thing and act another, people pick up on it right away.
I mean, you know, when we talked to Julian, you know, Julian was quite honest about the fact that he struggled from the people management point of view. And I think, you know, like to your comment, Scott, about that it's more art than science is because, yeah, like you kind of have to read the person first to figure out what formula or you know, like how you're going to kind of engage with them. And I think that's the art part, right? Where I think in the world of HR management systems and things like that, we think that, you know, you just got to take this cookie cutter approach to everyone at a certain level, in the organizational structure. I don't think that kind of works. I remember managing teams where, you know, like at the same level, I had people that were 50 and people that were 22. And so, you know, so just the aspect of, say them, you know, like showing up to work on a Friday morning would be kind of different, right? Because the 20-year-old is probably out on a Thursday night, whereas the 50-year-old is probably not out on a Thursday night, right? Like, so, I would have like, you know, and I remember having these conversations with HR sometimes where, you know, the 20-year-old would call in sick, probably because they were hungover. And yeah, like the 50-year-old would call sick because the kid was sick. And you know, like an HR would have a positive view on one, you know, like, oh, kid's sick, you know, that's acceptable. But, you know, a 20-year-old being hungover, they go, oh, that's unacceptable if they call in sick for that. And, you know, like, sometimes I would question them, like, yeah, at the 20-year-old's life, like, you know, where they are in their life, this is exactly an acceptable kind of behavior that I would expect. You know, like, I think it's responsible for them to call in sick if they're really hungover because they had a big night or they're not fit for work or whatever.
Beats the alternative.
Right, like, no, but realistically, how is it any different? The 50-year-old is making a call based on the part of life they're at and the 20-year-old. And I think that's the part of people management we get difficult is because, you know, we think that there should just be one approach, one set of rules that should apply to everyone. But I think that's the art part about how you actually manage those, you know, those little kind of discrepancies. I remember going to like the sports conference and there was a someone from like a football club that came in and they made this really interesting point where they kind of grouped their players into different like buckets based on the where they think they are in life. You know, so are they like, you know, they have the family, do they have kids? Yeah, well, they'll need a different type of support. So they try to group all of those players together so they can kind of help each other and, you know, they have a different set of rules. And then, you know, obviously in football clubs, you'll have the 18, 20-year-olds that just want to go partying all the time and they get put in a different group. And I think that's, you know, that to me is like a more sophisticated way of people management where you realize that, you know, like people are at different points in their life and their needs and requirements are going to be different. You know, whereas I think in large organizations, we sometimes try to do the cookie cutter approach. And I think that's to our detriment.
Yeah, I think there's quite a bit of research on that around who leads the team and what's the makeup of the team that deliver the best outcomes. And, you know, if you're managing your team are quite aligned, you know, you generally get better outcomes. And, you know, I think that's a conversation we don't have enough now because, you know, there's often a talk about, you know, you need to embrace the diversity, can be quite successful, right? Because you bring in all those different viewpoints and people. And certainly St. Ives, we had quite a diverse group and it worked. But there is, you know, there's a bit of research to say, well, actually, you know, if you have your leader is 30 with a couple of kids and the team's all 30 with a couple of kids, you're actually going to get really good outcomes because they're speaking the same language and, they're getting managed the way that their life is. So
and I guess on that front too, people will tend to have an easier time getting along with people of a similar peer group, right? And so, you know, if you have someone in their 20s who's hungover on Fridays and someone in their 50s who just really wants to show up until they can retire, you know, that there's going to be some tension there versus if they, you know, if you have, you know, like maybe you structure your team such as to take advantage of that and say, all right, we're going to have these people work together. And, you know, it's a big challenge, right? Like one of the things I was reflecting on was how much having someone like Malcolm as a figurehead where you watch how he interacts with his employees, like his direct reports, and then you watch how they interact with their direct reports, you start to model that interaction with your own direct reports, right? And so I was thinking about how much influence some of these people have in getting us to manage better by them managing better without saying you need to manage better, right? It's an interesting, like, how much maybe we should be modeling the behaviors we want. You know, like I remember hearing a thing with kids where, you know, kids will unintentionally, they don't plan to do this, but they'll make you feel the way they feel so that they can watch your reaction to it. Be like, oh, dad is pissed and he is yelling and throwing things. Guess what I'm going to do? And they don't think it, you know, on their own. They sort of do that, right? But I think, you know, like, though we're not children, there's a lot of that similarity in mankind, and where we emulate the behaviors of the people we respect, and we see how they deal in times of high stress. And if they're, you know, I remember hearing someone say, you know, like, oh yeah, it's like, you know, you're like a duck. And it's like, what? And it's like, yeah, you know, you're all calm on the surface and under the water, you're just kicking and kicking. and I don't know if that's the right thing to model, but I was thinking about, perhaps we should be more intentional about our own behaviors if we want people to do those things, right? So.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth at that. And, you know, I certainly took away, particularly with Malcolm, you know, it doesn't matter how busy or what was going on, the amount of time that he would spend with you to, you know, sort of see where I was and then spend time explaining things, you know, I don't know if you ever drew up on his whiteboard with you, but every time you go in there, he'd have another story drawn up on his whiteboard that he'd done to someone, and you'd go in there and he'd have to rub it off so he could draw it up for you. And for me, you know, that, you know, that taught me a lot, you know, and I sort of have taken that to this day. It's like, okay, you know, that's what you need to do. And it doesn't matter how busy you are. Like, if you're busy and you brush people off, that's what's going to happen. With your team or with your kids. So if you say, so, okay, cool, this is something that you've come to me with, and obviously, you know, before you've come to me, I assume you've done some stuff yourself or you know what's going on. Let's sort of map this out, and okay, this is where we're at, and this is, you know, what you could do next. Or usually, you know, you come up with what you need to do next. You know, but he would take that time, and I think that's so important.
What's something that you took away from St. Ives and that, like, guided the rest of your career?
I think the thing that that took away from St. Ives is you can take a team of people that, when you look at it on the surface, they're probably an average team. They're rocking up every day. They're doing their job. And then you don't really know how good that team is until you apply pressure. And I think that team at St. Ives went from, you know, we're a team, which is a pretty standard team. And then said, look, let's throw on another drill out at Invincible on the lake. It's the hardest conditions we've ever had, you know. And by the way, we're not giving you any more people. And then, you know, I think at one stage there, you know, we were, you know, the turnaround times, like holes were coming in off the lake in the morning, be dropped off at the koi out at 7:30. And, you know, they were getting dropped off, samples were getting dropped off at the lab that day in the afternoon, you know, logged, you know, Max has RQD photos cut. And I look at that and I go, man, this was really, like, genuinely amazing stuff. And so that team delivered, as I said, probably the best performance I've ever seen before or after. And I think if you had been there in 2011, you would have gone, yeah, okay, it's just a pretty standard team. And then you put that pressure on, and it's like, wow, actually, you know, this team actually has actually delivered more than what most people, I think, would have thought was possible. Well, I think it's, you know, you don't know how people will perform until you put them under pressure. And I think if, you know, if you've got those ingredients there where you've got that objective and the goal and the recognition that everyone's under pressure, I think you can actually achieve a lot. And, these people are critical to the process. And, you know, you can talk about, well, you know, things would have got to the lab eventually, you know, so maybe how critical was it? But when you work and you're drilling and you're trying to, you know, get funding for the next program and plan the next program, it certainly brings the time frame in a lot. So, you know, you think about how much time it took Invincible to get turned around. Like, that was, you know, largely due to the work that everyone was doing to minimize all of the gaps in the process So, you know, that's holes drilled, samples to the lab, you know, within a day or a day or two, making sure that, you know, we were talking to the lab and we were prioritizing samples. I think at one point we started sending samples to Perth, you know, just to make sure that we had that capacity to get these quick turnarounds. And so we could go and plan the next holes. And I think that's maybe what's missed is you look at these timelines, you know, there may not have been another way to make this happen in that time if you had just, you know, a group that fell apart or you were always having to hire people and bring new people in. You know, we never would have got, you know, the productivity or the quality control if we didn't have that team at that time.
Yeah, you think about what a 40% turnover rate year on year would have done to that, right? Like, you wouldn't have gone from first drill hole to first production in 34 months. It would have been, you know, 34 years. I sometimes wonder how great, it's almost like exponential growth in time when you don't have that just absolutely gelled team, right? Where it's, and maybe they wouldn't have gelled if it wasn't for that extreme circumstance, right? Yeah, it's inspiring to see that things, right? Like I always genuinely wish that everybody in the geosciences could see a discovery and feel that excitement and that pressure and that chaos, because there's nothing like it, right? It's just wild.
Yeah, and you know, I've been fortunate enough to have worked on a few, and you know, there's a lot of different things happening at different times. But that's certainly Invincible, and you know, and then Invincible South. You know, just great times out on the lake. Through the hills and the mountains wide, pickaxe swing and the earth unfolds, chasing dreams in the dirt and gold. Geology calling under our feet, secrets are buried in the rock and heat. With a heart full of wonder and a map in hand, exploring the treasures of this great land.